I'd like to welcome y'all on behalf of the Forums Committee of the Florida Union Board. The Forums Committee this year has tried to bring to the university some of the outstanding political and literary figures. And tonight, we feel that we are most fortunate to have with us a world traveler and a prominent American author, Mr. Erskine Caldwell. Mr. Caldwell was born in Georgia and educated at Erskine College, the University of Virginia, and the University of Pennsylvania. He received the Yale Award for Fiction in 1933, and he's written some 45 books and novels, of which I think God's Little Acre and Tobacco Road are probably the best known. Mr. Caldwell has also been a newspaper correspondent in Mexico, Spain, and Czechoslovakia. He is now a member of the Authors League of America and of the National Institute of Arts and Letters. Mr. Caldwell and his wife, Virginia, now live in Ream, California. They have recently traveled to the South for several months in preparation for his new book, In Search of Biscoe, which will be published in April of this year. The title of Mr. Caldwell's speech tonight is Out of the Caldwell Workshop. So it is with great pleasure and pride that I introduce to you one of our most prominent authors, Mr. Erskine Caldwell.
Students, faculty, and non-affiliated ladies and gentlemen. This is my first trip to the University of Florida, and I was a little bit puzzled today. I took a short tour around the campus, and I'm still not quite sure whether what I saw was a large parking lot or a large used car lot. And I wonder whether or not some of the buildings should not be taken down to make more space for cars. You may ask why I'm here. And I would say that I'm here because I was invited. And you may ask how I got here. Well, I got here from my home in California. And I came the usual way these days that people do who travel by jet planes, just a common, ordinary trip. And I'm sure all of you are familiar with it by now. As you know, in such cross-country jet trips these days, they send you up about 30, 40,000 feet. The colored motion pictures come on the screen. And in this case, presently the navigator left the cockpit, came back and poured the cocktails. And then in a little while, the captain and pilot left their flight deck and came back into the cabin, and they charcoaled the steaks. And of course, all the stewardesses took off their uniforms and put on Playboy Club bunny costumes. So that was a very uneventful trip. There was not nothing at all like a trip in an airplane a friend of mine took recently. He was invited to be a guest of the airplane company that is making a new supersonic automated airplane that goes something like 1,500 miles an hour. And he, with other guests, were invited to take a flight in this new supersonic automated airplane that's directed by computers on the ground, and it has no crew, no pilot, of course. And they went up, and presently, over the loud speaker, a recording came on and said, "Welcome aboard to the new supersonic automated aircraft of the future that is directed by computers on the ground." And of course, we have no crew. But presently, an automatic cart will come down the aisle and serve you cocktails. And after that, another automatic cart will come down the aisle and serve you dinner. So just lean back in your seats and have a good flight with us. And be assured that nothing can go wrong, go wrong, go wrong. So far, we haven't got very literary, but of course, everything that's written is not necessarily literary. You might take the case of the famous sea captain who died recently after a career of 50 years as a captain of a passenger liner that sailed between New York and Europe. And he had a perfect record of never having damaged his ship while landing at a dock and never having lost a passenger at sea. And he was such a celebrated captain that the junior officers were sure that he had a secret of success, and they wanted to know what it was. And they always noticed that before going up on the bridge to chart the course for the pilot, he always went into his cabin first for a few minutes. And after all these years, they were so curious about why he always went into his cabin for a few minutes before going to the bridge that they peeked through the window one day of his cabin to see what he did while he was in there. Well, what they saw was that he unlocked a drawer of his desk and took out a piece of paper. And then he would read this over as though memorizing it. And while he was doing that, he was making gestures first with his left hand and then with his right hand. Well, naturally, when the captain died recently, the junior officers rushed to the cabin, the first thing, unlocked this desk drawer, and took out the slip of paper to see what secret of success was written on this piece of paper. And this is what they found. And they read it off. "The port side of the ship is the left-hand side. Starboard is the right-hand side." The starting point of a writer of fiction is usually as vague and lost in the past as a person's first remembered moment of consciousness as a child. All we can say is that one day it happened to us, because that was when we found ourselves trying to write a story. And even if we should recall where and when this took place, the reason why it happened is likely to remain a lifelong mystery. Anyway, no matter what happened, many of us, during those long years of struggle and strife and other economic and perhaps marital difficulties, would have eagerly gone back in time and place and put up a pitiful plea for the chance to choose a less inhumane and more compassionate occupation in life. But the urge, or to express it as it should be, this perverse dictate of fate, which decrees that a person, any person, is to become a writer, whether he wants to be a writer or not, is as ruthless in its demand as a stomach is for its daily food. There may not be such a person as a natural-born writer, but if that's the way it's going to be, no one can run away and prevent writing from being thrust upon him. Thereafter, he endures his fate in life just as everyone else must accept the fact that he might as well stop complaining about his allotted affliction and learn to live with it the best he can. And so now that writing is to be done in a person who expects the ability to come to him with no effort, is likely to bemoan his fate if his writing is not immediately successful and financially rewarding. But naturally, it is neither of these two things in the beginning, because words put together, one after the other, have no meaning or purpose unless their cumulative effect conveys more than ordinary thought, action, perception, and implication. And as the final result, after months and years of effort, does not produce a story, all is purposeless, worthless, and a waste of everybody's time and patience. This means that there is no excuse for attempting to write fiction unless a person is subject to the compulsion to write and has the talent to accomplish it. The restless housewife with nothing better to do is not necessarily a compulsive writer, and the retired traveling salesman is not necessarily a talented writer merely because he can recall some of the lurid details of his youthful escapades on the road. Nevertheless, a considerable number of people are curious about what is thought to be the secret of writing, and many of them yearn for the time when this magic secret is revealed to them so that they too can become writers. But there is no secret. Magic, esoteric, or practical, the ability to become a writer is merely the result of combining compulsion and talent in ideal proportions under favorable conditions, such as the right phase of the moon, and with fingers firmly crossed. And from then on, it is to be as luck will have it. But even though there is no secret to be revealed, and even if luck is a writer's best friend, the world is full of people without compulsion and without talent who somehow acquire and doggedly cultivate the ambition to be writers. This can be a harmless pastime and as good a hobby as finger painting, or stamp collecting, as long as a person is content with the pride of an amateur. However, if he becomes desperate for a professional achievement and public acclaim, there is a danger of his resorting to the imitation of an accomplished writer or attending so-called creative writing courses at a university. The only excuse for the first of these, imitation, is when the result becomes good satire or burlesque. And the only excuse for the second of these, attending creative writing courses, is when it is realized that fiction writing is a dramatic account of possible human experiences that are infused with tragic, comic, or romantic implications. Consequently, experience and imagination are among the prime sources of fiction, and so-called creation is merely the practical use of them. But that's the trouble about talking about these things. We become involved in generalities, semantics, and suppositions. It's a good subject for argument and debate. But if we kept on like this, I would not have a chance to tell about one person who early in life felt that he had the compulsion to be a writer, and then spent a long time trying to find out if he had the talent to be one. Being more familiar with my own case history than I am with that of anyone else, it would seem to be reason enough to talk about me. And speaking personally, I do know that while never lacking in compulsion, I am still not too sure about the talent. But I can attest to the fact that luck, and I mean the lucky kind of luck, has never been a handicap to any writer. I was in my high school teens in the state of Georgia, and I had a craving, an unsatisfied craving, perhaps in the same way that a person has a craving for a candy bar, or a cow will have a craving for a lick of salt. I had a craving for a typewriter. And the only way for me to get one was to collect scrap iron and earn enough money to pay for one at the rate of $1 a week. Perhaps it could be said that the typewriter was symbolic of a desire to be a writer, but I prefer to think I was merely being practical about it. And it could be pointed out that a wise and knowing person would first of all want to complete his college education, including a course in creative writing. But I was too impatient to wait any longer to try to write the story of life around me. And I was not a college dropout. I was an in-and-out college student for many years. There's a big difference. There's always plenty to write about in a small community where you know the name of every dog in town, as well as a reason why the 16-year-old bride was spanked on her wedding night and sent back home to mother. But the trouble is, you have to learn by trial and error how to tell a story in the printed word. And a typewriter itself is not going to show you how it is done. It is enough to say that for me it was 10 years of trial and much error. Newspaper reporting and odd jobs for survival before I succeeded in getting the first short story published in a magazine. The fact that the magazine made no payment for the story was no cause for unhappiness. At a time like that, after those long years, seeing the printed page was satisfaction enough. And when you're young and dedicated, money can wait. It is only when you're older that it begins to make a difference. There may have been shorter cuts to reach the same goal, but if there were, I have no regrets for the way I took. It was along the way I went that I discovered that experience, the experience of living, whether pleasant or unpleasant, contributes to the basic material of fiction. And it was my good fortune to be able to acquire a considerable amount of both kinds of experience during that period of learning how. After that period of apprenticeship, for the past 30 years, I have continued to seek experience by going and living and being wherever it is to be found. But personal experiences are not always thrilling and exciting. They are only thrilling and exciting when they are written into an autobiography. But the doings of other people are never dull when what they do makes a story to be told. Before it is assumed that the act of acquiring a typewriter is a guarantee of a successful career as a writer, it should be taken into account that there are a lot of ifs and buts about it. This is something I learned early in life in the non-scholastic school of economics and in an off-campus course in sociology. This took place in the 1920s. After I had owned my first typewriter for more than a year, I began wandering through the South, the Deep South, taking a small suitcase and my typewriter with me. After several months, I got as far as Baltimore. And it was there that a trusting landlady rented me a room with no payment in advance. A week later, the landlady's husband came home unexpectedly, and he was quick to discover that I was a non-paying guest, and he lost no time in telling me that if I did not pay 2 weeks' rent in advance by noon the next day, he was going to lock me out of my room, confiscate my suitcase and my typewriter. And he told me some other things too, but that's another story. And so there I was. And there was only one thing to do. I took the typewriter to a pawn shop and pawned it for $10. Now I had a place to sleep and I had my suitcase, but I had no typewriter. After a long night of anguish, being parted from my typewriter for the first time, I went back to the pawn shop and pleaded with the pawnbroker to let me use a typewriter in his back room of the shop to write a story. He agreed, provided that I would spend as much time cleaning his stock of guns and pistols as I spent typing. I have no recollection of the particular story I was trying to write at the time in the back room of the pawn shop, but I do know that the pawnbroker was as kind-hearted as the landlady had been before her husband came home unexpectedly. After almost 2 weeks, I had cleaned and oiled every firearm, polished every clock, and restrung every banjo in the pawn shop. And that was when the pawnbroker read the story I had written and said that he had no idea what kind of value it had, if any. But he said that I had earned back my typewriter and $5 in cash in addition. And I've had a good feeling about Baltimore ever since. The ifs and buts of possessing a typewriter as a tool of writing for the creative process have both symbolic and practical consequences. This could be called evidence of the typewriter syndrome. I found this out in Hollywood several years after the Baltimore episode. This was in the 1930s. I had traveled by bus from New York to Los Angeles, and I carried a small suitcase and a new full-size typewriter. I had no more ambition to be a Hollywood screenwriter than I'd had to be a pawnbroker's assistant in Baltimore. My only aim then, as always, was to have movement and to find experience, varieties of experience, wherever I could. Having lived on a bus for almost 5 days and five nights, I was ready for a conventional bed and 24 hours of constant sleep when I arrived in Hollywood and went to the first small hotel I could see. I had enough money to pay $5 weekly rent and to pay it in advance. And the hotel had plenty of rooms at that rate, and I was ready to sign the register and hand over the money. However, before I could sign my name on the register, the hotel clerk took one look at the big typewriter and shook his head determinedly. No amount of arguing could persuade the hotel clerk to change his mind and let me have a room. He said it was against the policy of the hotel to rent rooms to writers at any price because, he said, writers always went broke eventually and failed to pay their room rent. And more than that, he said, writers would lower their typewriters from the windows at night to keep them from being confiscated for non-payment of rent. As I left the hotel, I looked back and saw the name of it for the first time. It bore the name of a famous American author of the past century. And I am sure if Mark Twain knew about it, he would have done something about it. There was another small hotel in the next block of the street, it having a common, ordinary California name, such as Pink Orange Blossom or Green Royal Palm. Anyway, it was late in the evening then, almost midnight, and I was becoming more sleepy and groggy by the minute when I went into this second hotel. When I went in, a pleasant-mannered, elderly woman with bright blonde hair said the rent would be $5 a week, not payable in advance, and she even apologized for not having a bellboy to carry the heavy typewriter to my room. And then when I signed the hotel register, she looked at my home and dress and smiled even more pleasantly. She said she was from Georgia too and was always glad to see anybody from the old home. After she had taken me to my room, she closed the curtains over the windows, turned back the bed covering, and then said she was going to give me a special reduced rate of $4 a week. And then as she left, she said, I looked very tired, and that she was going to put a do not disturb sign on my door so I could sleep late the next morning.